Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
The Way of Chuang Tzu, a book about Taoism, spirituality. I didn't actually think it was going to be about this. I thought it was going to be the rules of war. So there you go. But reading through it, we're up to page 14, and this 1965 academic has really researched into it and noted that most scholars somehow tend to read more broadly, and this is a 3rd century BC witticist, insightful humanist Taoist scholar. And I'll continue from where I think I've left off. The way of Tao is to begin with the simple good with which one is endowed by the very fact of existence, instead of self-conscious cultivation of this good, which vanishes when we look at it and becomes intangible when we try to grasp it. We grow quietly in humility of a simple, ordinary life, and in this way is analogous to the Christian life of faith. It is more a matter of believing in the good than seeing the fruit of one's effort. The secret proposed by Chuang Tzu is therefore not the accumulation of virtue and merit through Taobaidu, but Wu Wei, the non-doing, the non-action, which is not intent on result and is not concerned with consciously laid plans or deliberately organized endeavors. My greatest happiness consists precisely of doing nothing, whatever that is calculated to obtain happiness. Perfect joy is to be without joy. If you ask what ought to be done and what ought not to be done on earth to produce happiness, I answer that these questions do not have a fixed and predetermined answer. End quote. To suit every case. If one is in harmony with Tao, the cosmic Tao, the great Tao, the answer will make itself clear when it comes to act, for then one will act not according to human and self-conscious mode of deliberation, but according to the divine spontaneous mode of Wu Wei, which is a mode of action of Tao itself, and therefore a source of all good. That sounds gibbledygook to me, my godfather. The other way, the way of conscious striving, even though it may claim to be a way of virtue, is fundamentally a way of self-aggrandizement. It is not consequently bound to come into conflict with Tao. Hence, it is self-destructive, for what is against Tao will cease to be. This explains why Tao Te Ching, criticizing Zhu philosophy, says that the highest of virtue is not virtuous, and therefore it is a virtue. My God, that's brain spinning. But low virtue never frees itself from virtuousness, therefore it has no virtue. Chuang Tzu is not against virtue, why should he be? But he sees that mere virtuousness without meaning, without deep effect, either in life of the individual or in society. Going across here. Once this is clear, we can see that Chuang Tzu is ironic statements about righteousness and ceremonies are made not in the name of lawless hedonism and antinomianism, I don't know what that is, but in the name of genuine virtue, which is beyond virtuousness. Well, I sort of understand that. Once this is clear, one can reasonably be certain analogy between Chuang Tzu and St. Paul. My godfather, this is mixed up, mate. The analogy must certainly not be pushed too far. Chuang Tzu lacks the profoundly theological and mysticism of St. Paul, but his teaching about spiritual liberty of Wu Wei and the relation to virtue in underwelling Tao is analogous to Paul's teaching of faith and grace contrasted with the words of the old law. The relation of Chuang Tzu's book to the Analects of Confucius is not unlike the epistles of the Galatians and the Romans to the Torah. For Chuang Tzu, the great man is therefore not the man who has, by a lifetime of study and practice, accumulated a great fund of virtue and merit, but a man in whom Tao acts without impediment, a man of Tao. Several of this text in this present book describes the man of Tao. Others tell what he's not. One of the most instructive in this respect is the long, delightful story of the anxiety-ridden perfectionist disciple of Chen Sang Chul, who is sent to Lao Tzu to learn the elements. He is told that if you persist in trying to attain what has never attained, in reasoning about what cannot be understood, you will be destroyed. Oh my God. On the other hand, if you can only not know when to stop, be content to wait, listen, and give up useless strivings, this melts the ice. He will begin to grow without watching himself grow and without the appetite for self-improvement. This sounds like in the age before internet and advanced science and standard theory. Chuang Tzu surrounded his ambitions supposedly surrounded by ambitious supposedly practical men and reflected that these operators knew the value of useful but not the greater value of uselessness of the useless. As John Woo put it, quote, to Chuang Tzu, the world must have looked like a terrible tragedy written by a great comedian. He saw scheming politicians falling into pits they had dug for others. He saw predatory states swallowing weaker states, who are only to be swallowed in their turn by stronger ones. Thus, the much vaunted unity and useful talents proved not only useless, but self-destructive. The man of Tao will prefer obscurity and solitude. He will not seek public office, even though he may recognize that the Tao, which inwardly forms the sage, outwardly forms the king. In the turtle, Chuang Tzu delivers a curt, definite refusal to those who come to tempt him away from his fishing on the riverbank in order to give him a job in the capital. He has even more blunt response when his friend Hu Zhu suspects him of plotting to supplant him in the official job, Owl of the Phoenix. My God, this is going to be bizarre book reading. On the other hand, Chuang Tzu is not merely a, let's reading this next page, not merely a, page 14 to 17 to 18, a professional recluse. The man of Tao does not make the mistake of giving up self-conscious virtuousness in order to immerse himself in even more self-conscious contemplative recollections. One cannot call Chuang Tzu a contemplative in the sense of the one who adopts a systematic program of spiritual self-purification in order to attain a certain definite interior experience or even merely to cultivate the interior life. Chuang Tzu would condemn this just as roundly as the cultivation of anything else in the artificial basis. All deliberate, systematic, and reflective self-cultivation, whether active or contemplative, personalistic or politically committed, cuts one off from the mysterious but indispensable contact with Tao, the hidden mother of all life and truth. One of the things that causes the young disciple King Sang Chu to be utterly frustrated is precisely that he shuts himself up in a cell and tries to cultivate qualities which he thinks desirable to get rid of others he dislikes. A contemplative interior life which would simply make the subject more aware of himself and permit him to become obsessed with his own interior progress would, for Chuang Tzu, be use no less than illusion than the act of life of a benevolent man who would try in his own efforts to impose his idea of good on those who might oppose his ideas, and thus in his eyes become enemies of good. Like what you can see, proselytizing. The true tranquility sought by the man of Tao is the yin ning, yin ning, tranquility in action of non-action. In other words, a tranquility of that transcends the division between activity and contemplation by entering into a union with the nameless, invisible Tao. Chuang Tzu insists everywhere that this means abandoning the need to win. See Fighting Cock. In Monkey Mountain, he shows the peril of cleverness and virtuosity. Oh my God, my ear's itching at the moment. Sorry for itching my ear on podcast. Was it some sort of mossy eating me? He's even more blunt response when his friend Xu Zhu suspects him of plotting to supplant his official job, the Owl and the Phoenix. On the other hand, Chuang Tzu is not merely a... Page 17 to 19, we'll get through this eventually, guys. And girls, I don't think any girl will listen to this. Professional recluse. The Man of Tao does not make the mistake of giving up self-conscious virtuousness in order to immerse himself in the even more self-conscious contemplative reflection. One cannot call Chao Xing a contemplative in the sense that one adopts the systematic program of spiritual self-purification. Chuang Tzu would condemn this just as roundly as cultivation as anything else on the artificial basis. All deliberate, systematic and reflexive self-cultivation, whether active or contemplative, personalistic or politically committed, cuts one off from the mysterious but indispensable contact. Oh, I think I've read this before. Have I read this? A contemplative and interior life would simply make the subject more aware of himself and permit him to become obsessed with his own interior. Chuang Tzu no less an illusion than an active life. I've read this before. Let me read. Chuang Tzu insists everywhere that this means abandoning the need to win. The Monkey Man have done this. Somehow I've missed this, or they've written the page twice. No one is wrong as the man who knows all the answers. No one is so wrong as the man who knows all the answers. Like Lu Zhu, Master Chuang preaches an essential humility. Not the humility of virtuous and unconscious and conscious self-abasement, in which the end is never entirely free from uncutious of the Uriah Heep. I don't know where that comes from Dickens. But the basic, one might say, ontological or cosmic humility of man who fully realizes with his own nothingness and becomes totally forgetful of himself, like a dry tea stamp, dead ashes. One may call this humility cosmic, not only because it is rooted in the true nature of things, but also because it's full of life and awareness, responding to the boundless vitality and the joy of living beings. It manifests itself everywhere in a Franciscan simplicity and co-naturality of all living creatures. Half the characters who are brought before us speak the mind of Chuang Tzu are animals, birds, fishes, frogs, and so on. Chuang Tzu's Taoism is nostalgic. Going in for a real Disney adventure here, aren't we? Or more Shrek, it sounds like. For my mortal climate of paradise, in which there is no differentiation, in which man is utterly simple, unaware of himself, living at peace with himself, with Tao, with all other creatures. But for Chuang, this is paradise, not something that can be irrevocably lost by sin and cannot be regained except by redemption. It's still ours, but we do not know it, since the effect of life and society to complicate and confuse our existence, making us forget who we really are, by causing us to become obsessed with what we are not. If this self-awareness, which we try to increase and perfect by all sorts of methods and practices, that is really forgetful of our true roots in the unknown Tao, of our solitary in his uncarved block, in which there are yet no distinctions. This is a bit hard to get through. Chuang Tzu's paradoxical teaching that you can never find happiness until you stop looking for it must not therefore be negatively interpreted. He is not preaching a retreat from a full active human existence into inertia and quietism. In fact, he's saying that happiness can be found not only by not seeking and non-action. It can be found not as a result of a program or system. A program or system has this advantage. It tends to situate happiness in one kind of action only and seek it only there. But happiness and freedom for Chuang Tzu saw in Tao is the only found everywhere, since Tao is everywhere. Until one can learn to act with such freedom from care, that action is, quote, perfect joy because without joy. Perfect joy because without joy. One cannot really be happy in anything. Fong Yung Lan sums it up in his Spirit of Chinese Philosophy, page 77, with the sage will accompany everything and welcome everything, everything being the course of being constructed and in the course of being destroyed. Hence, he cannot obtain joy and freedom, and his joy is unconditional. Oh, dear. The true character of Wu Wei is not merely inactivity, but perfect action, because it is act without activity. In other words, it is action not carried out independently of heaven and earth in conflict with the dynamism of the whole, but perfectly harmony with the whole. It is not mere passivity, but in action it seems both effortless and spontaneous, because performs rightly in perfect accordance with our nature and in our plane in the scheme of things. It is completely free because there is no force and no violence. It is not conditioned or limited by our own individual needs and desires. It's not our own theories or ideas. It is precisely unconditional character of Wu Wei that differentiates Chuang Tzu from other great philosophers who constructed systems by which their activities would necessarily be conditioned. An abstract theory of universal love preached by Mo Ti was hugely seen by Shan too as false, precisely because of the inhumanity of its consequences. In theory, Mo Ti led to all men should be loved with all equal love, and that the individual should. And this is bizarre. You can imagine, you contrast this with the Chinese state at the moment. His own greatest good of loving the common good of all, the universal love, was rewarded by tranquility, peace, and good order, and all happiness of the individual. But this universal love will be found upon examination, like most other utopian projects, to be made of severe demands upon human nature that cannot be realized. And indeed, even if it could be realized, it would in fact cramp and distort man, eventually ruining him and his society. This is this thing about the never-ending utopian. Not because love is not good and natural to man, but because the system constructed on a theoretical and abstract principle of love ignores certain fundamental mysterious realities of which we cannot be fully conscious. And the price we pay for the inattention is that our love is in fact becomes hate. Hence the society of universal love, planned by Mu Tin, was drab, joyless, grim, since all spontaneous order satisfactions of Confucian life, of friendship, ritual, music, and so on, were banned by Mo Ti. Music, in Confucius, I suppose. Chang Xing defends music and writes, though in other places he laughs at the exaggerated love of them. Mo Ti, he says, would have no singing in life, no more in death. Notwithstanding, men will sing, he condemns singing. He will mourn, men will mourn, and still he condemns mourning. Men will express joy, and still he condemns it. This is truly in accord with a man's nature. In life's toil and death's stinginess, his way is hard and heartless. Well, it sounds a bit like an Oliver Cromwell, warts and all time man. From such a passage as we can see that Chuang Tzu's own irony about elaborate funerals is to be seen in its own light. The amusing and, of course, entirely fictitious description of Lao Tzu's wake gives Chuang the opportunity to criticise not mourning as such, or even the piety towards one's master, but the artificial attachments formed by the cult of the master of a master as master. The Tao of disciplineship is for Chuang a figment of imagination, and is no way substitute for the great Tao. in which all relationships find a proper order and expression. That Chuang Tzu should be able to take one side of the question in one place and then the other in another context warns us that in reality he is beyond mere partisan dispute. Though he is a social critic, his criticism is never bitter or harsh. Irony and parable are his chief instruments, and the whole climate of his work is one of tolerant impartiality, which avoids preaching and recognizing the uselessness of dogmatizing about obscure ideas that even philosophers were not prepared to understand. Though he did not follow other men and their follies, he did not judge them severely. He knew that he had follies of his own and had a good sense to accept the fact and enjoy it. He sounds a bit like Epicurus. In fact, he saw one basic characteristic of the sage that he recognises, my God, this is going on, my Godfather, himself to be as other men are. He does not set himself apart from others and above them, and yet there is a difference. He differs, quote, in his heart from the other men, since he is centred on Tao and not himself. But he does not know in what way he is different. He is also aware of his relatedness to others, his union with them, but he does not understand this either. He merely lives it. The key to Chuang Tzu thought is complementary of opposites. And this can be seen, this is the, is it Kant opposite? Was it Leibniz opposites? I can't remember. It's just send you mad readiness. It can be seen only when he grasps the central pivot of Tao, which passes squarely through both yes and no, I and not I, the not at, not being. It's like Kant. I've got to reread Kant. Life is a continual development. All beings are in the state of flux. Chuang Tzu would have agreed with Heraclitus. What is impossible today may suddenly become possible tomorrow. What is good and pleasant today may tomorrow be evil and odious. What seems right from one point of view may, when seen in a different aspect, manifest itself as completely wrong. What then should a wise man do? Should he simply remain indifferent? He should study quantum physics, I'd say. Should he simply remain indifferent to the great right and treat right and wrong, good and bad, as if they were all the same? Chuang Tzu would be the first to deny that they were the same, but in doing so, he would refuse to grasp one or the other and cling to it as absolute. When limited and conditioned view of good is erected to a level of an absolute, it immediately becomes an evil, because it excludes certain complementary elements which are required for it to be fully good. To cling to one partial view, one limited and conditioned opinion, and to treat this as an ultimate answer to all questions is simply to obscure Tao, to make oneself obdurate in error. He who grasps the central pivot of Tao is able to watch yes and no pursue their alternating course around the circumference. He retains his respectful and clarity and judgment, so he knows that yes is yes, in the light of which no stands for over and against it. He understands that happiness, when pushed to the extreme, becomes calamity, that beauty, when overdone, becomes ugliness, clouds become rain, vapour ascends again to become clouds. To insist that the clouds should never turn to rain is to resist the death dynamism of Tao. The ideas are applied to Chuang Tao, to the work of the artist and the craftsman, as well as to the teacher and the philosopher. In the woodcarver, we see that the accomplished craftsman does not simply proceed according to a certain fixed rules and external standards to do this. Of course, perfectly all right is all right for a mediocre artisan, but superior work proceeds from a hidden spiritual principle which, in fasting detachment, forgetfulness results in abandonment of all hope of profit, discovery precisely the tree that is awaiting to have this. Oh my Godfather, what's going on? This speaks to work carved from it. That's intense, isn't it? In such a case, The artist works as though passively, and it is Tao that works through him. This is the favourite theme of Chuang Tzu. We find it often repeated. The right way of making things is beyond self-consciousness of action, for when the shoe fits, the foot is forgotten. In the teaching of philosophy, Chuang Tzu is not in favour of putting the tight shoes that make disciples in senseless consciousness of the fact that he has feet, because they torment him. For that very reason, Chuang is critical not only of Confucians who are too attached to the method and the systems, but also to Taoists who try to impart knowledge of unnameable Tao when it cannot be imparted and when the hearer is not even ready to receive the first elements of instructions about it. Symphony for a Seabird is to be read in this light. It is not applied merely to the deadening of spontaneity of an artificial insistence of the true philosophy, but also the wrongheadedness and badly timed zeal of communication of Tao. In fact, Tao cannot be communicated, yet communicated itself in its own way. When the right moment arrives, even one who seems incapable of instruction whatsoever will become mysteriously aware of Tao. Meanwhile, that's a promise, like a door-to-door salesman. Meanwhile, though he consistently disagreed with his friend and dialectician, Hu Su, that though his disciples were not without the need to win, always represented Chuang as beating Hu in a debate. Su actually used many of Hu Zhu's metaphysical ideas. He realized that, by the principle of complementary, his own thought was not complete merely in itself without opposition of Hu Zhu. That sounds so much like the Enlightenment philosophers. One of the most famous things of all Chuang Tzu's principles is called the Three in the Morning, from the story of the monkeys who keep it planned to give them three measures of chestnuts in the morning and four in the evening. But when they complained, he changed his plan and gave them four in the morning and three in the evening. What does the story mean? Simply that the monkeys were foolish and that the keeper cynically outsmarted them? Quite the contrary. The point is rather that the keeper had enough sense to recognise the monkeys had irrational reasons of their own for wanting four measures of chestnuts in the morning, and did not summarily insist on the original arrangement. He was not totally indifferent, and yet he saw the accidental difference did not affect the substance of his arrangement. Nor did he waste time demanding that the monkeys try to be more reasonable, not when the monkeys were not expected to be reasonable in the first place. It is when he insists most firmly that everyone else is being reasonable that we become ourselves unreasonable. Chuang Tzu, firmly centered on Tao, could see. That's sort of. Oh dear, we're coming to the end. Oh no, yes we are. Hooray, we're getting into him soon. These things in perspective. His teachings follows the principle of the three in the morning, that is, at home. On two levels, that the divine and the invisible Tao has no name, the ordinary, simple, everyday existence. That really blew my brain out. The monkey is getting three serves in the morning. What the heck? That's a bit much for me. Let us read the first. Now, we've read enough of the Western overthought. Here we are to fuel the useless tree. And it's a beautiful poem. How long does it go for? Two pages. So I'm just going to read that and we'll finish this off. The Useless Tree. Hu Zhu said to Chuang, "I have a big tree. The kind of tree is called a stink tree. The trunk is so distorted, it's full of knots. No one can get a straight plank out of it. The branches are so crooked, it cannot cut them up. In any way that makes sense. There it stands beside the road, no carpenter will even look at it. Such is your teaching, big and useless." Chuang Tzu replied, "Have you ever watched the wildcat crouching, watching his prey? This way it leaps, and that way, high and low, and at last it lands in the trap, whatever that means. But have you seen the yak, the great thundercloud? He stands in his might. Be sure he can't catch mice. Well, a yak can't catch mice. There you go. So for your big tree, and no use. And when the plant, and then plant it in a wasteland, in emptiness, walk wildly around, rest under its shadow. No axe or bill prepares its end. No one will ever cut it down. Useless, you should worry. So, I don't know what the yak and a wild... The yak cannot catch a mouse. I don't quite... That's a bit beyond me. But the idea is that... the idea of... putting a vacant mind, a useful mind, into a high-powered job. This is going to become unstuck. Pretty interesting. Okay, I'm just going to continue from this, and we're into poems now. Let's go.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.